Welcome, everyone. Today is March 7th, 2013, and this is virtual panel session number 8 of the Ontology Summit, titled Ontology Evaluation Across the Ontology Lifecycle. This session is track A on the intrinsic aspects of ontology evaluation, and together with Leo Oberst and myself, we are co-champions, myself being Steve Ray, co-championing this track. And I'm not going to go into a lot of detail as to what we've done so far because we have four speakers and time is going to be a little bit tight. But by very brief introduction, then we have four talks which are continuing the intrinsic evaluation theme of this summit. Going from, again, some very structural evaluation, Patrick Lambrix from Linköping University in Sweden is going to be explaining how he can debug essentially the absence or the erroneous use of the is-a relationship in ontologies. Maria Copeland, University of Manchester, is going to be approach to the ontologies. So actually examining the appearance and disappearance of elements of an ontology during its life cycle as it progresses over time. Then we have Melissa Handel of Oregon Health and Science University, who is going to be talking about some of the key qualities, if you like, or issues of synonymy across multiple ontologies from the perspective of biological applications. And finally, Ed Barkmeyer at NIST will be pointing out some of the core, if you like, patterns or elements of ontologies that enable higher quality in those ontologies. And as a final note, I'm just happy to say that we have some good examples here of testing with real heavy-duty industrial strength ontologies, so it's not just abstract conjecture. These are some real ontologies that have been put through the mill on some of these talks you'll see. So I think we'll have some further grounding for discussion of evaluation of intrinsic properties of ontologies and as a complement to the other sessions where we've been talking on some of those sessions about the extrinsic aspect of ontology. So with that, I'd like to just move right ahead into the talk so we have enough time for questions and answers afterwards. And the first talk today we're going to hear from is Professor Patrick Lambrix from Sweden on the is-a structure, debugging is-a structure in ontologies. Patrick, are you online?
I am.
Okay. And then I trust people can bring up his slides either offline and look at them on their own system, or you're on the VNC. So Patrick, please go ahead.
Okay, thanks. So I want to talk today about debugging is a structure in ontologies. And this is work together with my students Valentina and Zlatan and my colleague Fang. Slide 2. There are a number of defects in ontologies, and probably the easiest kind are the syntactic defects, which could be things like wrong tags or incorrect formats. More interesting and more severe defects are things like semantic defects and modeling defects, and I will give examples of both of those. Semantic defects can be things like unsatisfiable concepts or incoherent and inconsistent ontologies, where an unsatisfiable concept is a concept to which no instance can belong. Incoherent ontology is an ontology that contains such concepts, and inconsistent ontology are ontologies that contain an inconsistency. And modeling defects would be things like wrong or missing is relations. Slide 3. So here we have an example of an incoherent ontology. It's an example from the DICE ontology where the concept brain is defined as a central nervous system and the body part, and it has a number of other properties as well. It's also defined that a central nervous system is a nervous system, and as well that body part and nervous systems are disjoint. So what we know then is that brain is a central nervous system and therefore a nervous system, as well as a body part, and as body part and nervous systems are disjoint, brain can actually not have any instances. Next slide. an example of modeling defects are missing iterations. And this is actually relatively common. The first time that we looked at this was when we looked at the ontologies of the Ontology Alignment Evaluation Initiative, the anatomy track, where they have two ontologies, adult mouse anatomy and NCI thesaurus anatomy, as well as 988 mappings between these two ontologies. And by using logical derivation, it's actually quite easy to figure out that there are 121 iterations missing in the first ontology and 83 missing in the second ontology. Slide 5. Missing iterations actually have a large impact on semantically enabled applications. So if you look at ontology-based querying, in this example, we're going to search PubMed for the term scleral diseases. Now, scleral diseases is a mesh term, and therefore PubMed will take into account the classes that are below in the hierarchical relationship there. So, for instance, it will take into account the scleritis, this scleral disease, and it will augment the query using scleritis. This will give us 1,363 articles. In slide 6, if this relationship between scleritis and scleral diseases would be missing, however, then we would only receive 613 articles, which would mean that 55% of the results are missed. Slide 7. So, although ontologies with defects often are useful, they also lead to problems when they're used in semantically enabled applications. So, wrong conclusions may be derived or valid conclusions may be missed. So, slide 8. So for the remaining of the talk, I'm going to focus on these modeling defects, which are missing and wrong is a structure. And we'll do it in a simple kind of ontologies, which are taxonomies. So slide 9, I will talk about give some definitions, talk about our approach, some experiments, and then conclude the talk. So let's start with the definitions. Slide 10 and then slide 11. So we're going to do this in the setting of a taxonomy network, where a taxonomy network consists of a set of taxonomies as well as mappings between these taxonomies. And slide 12, so the focus will be on the modeling defects, the wrong and missing iterations. And a particular characteristic of these defects is that a solution actually requires domain knowledge. Often a domain expert is needed to validate the solutions. Slide 13. So we're focusing on taxonomies, which means that we mainly have named concepts or atomic concepts, and we have iterrelations or atomic concepts subsumptions. In this part of the talk, we will assume that all the existing mappings in the taxonomy are correct, and that these mappings can represent equivalence relations or subsumption relations. Slide 14. So the task that we have done is that given that we have a set of taxonomies which are networked by these correct mappings, how can we detect and repair the missing and wrong iterrelations in these taxonomies? Slide 15. So the detecting of missing iterrelations can be done in different ways. One way is that the domain expert is doing inspection of the ontology. We could also use external knowledge. For instance, the ontology learning area has lots of approaches to find relationships between terms. There are also different approaches to discover subsumption relations using patterns, for instance, linguistic patterns like Hirsch patterns, but also logical patterns. In our work, we have focused on using knowledge that is intrinsic to the network. So for debugging one ontology, we're going to use the other ontologies and the mappings as external knowledge. Next slide. So the way that we do it is by trying to detect candidate missing iterrelations. An iterrelation A is a B is a candidate missing iterrelation if it can be derived from the network but not from the ontology alone. So on the figure we have A as B, you see the derivation paths through the network, but A is a B is not actually in the network. Then we call this a candidate missing is a relation. Now, as these can be derived from knowledge that may actually be wrong in the other ontologies or in the mappings, we need a domain expert to validate these. So the domain expert will partition the candidate missing is a relations into wrong is a relations and missing is a relations. Slide 17. Here we have an example. We have two small pieces of the ontologies that I mentioned before, the mouse anatomy and the National Cancer Institute's anatomy ontology. And we have three equivalence mappings. Now, by following the red arrows, we can actually see that in the first ontology, we can deduce that hip joint is a joint is missing there, because hip joint is equivalent to hip joint in the other ontology. Then hip joint in the other ontology is a joint. And then we go back with via the equivalence mapping to join in the first ontology. And in a similar way, we can see that elbow joint is a joint is missing in the first one. So here there are candidate missing is a relations, and both of these would be validated by a domain expert as being missing is a relations. So slide 18. What we would like to do then, once we have detected the missing and wrong is a relations, is to repair the taxonomies in such a way that we add is a relations to each taxonomy so that the missing is a relations will be derivable from the extended taxonomy. And we remove is a relations from the taxonomies such that the wrong is a relations cannot be derived in the network anymore. The solutions, the sets of is a relations to add and remove, we call a structural repair. And the actual is a relations we call repairing actions. Slide 19. Now, there are different ways to repair those missing is a relations. So if we want to repair hip joint is a joint and elbow joint in a joint, the easiest way is to just add them to the ontology. And this is structural repair one. Now, if we would have all the missing is a relations, then there's actually nothing more to do. We just add them. We may use a reasoning mechanism to derive all the conclusions, but there's nothing more to be done. However, most of these detection mechanisms do not find all the missing is relations. For instance, the linguistic patterns approach, the precision is very high, but recall is actually very low. So when you do not have all the missing is relations, there are actually other possibilities as well. In structural repair two, we have added the two missing ones plus an additional one. In structural repair three, we have added limb joint is a joint. And this will actually repair hip joint is a joint and elbow joint is a joint. Because hip joint is a limb joint, and then if you add limb joint is a joint, then hip joint is a joint is derivable. And the same for elbow joint is a joint. And in structural repair four, we would add limb joint is a joint as well as forelimb joint is a joint. All of these are correct solutions. And then the question is, how would we recognize the repairs that are most interesting for a domain expert? In this case, the domain expert would likely prefer to add limb joint is a joint because it is correct according to the domain. And it also allows us to derive everything that all the others would allow us to derive. So to be able to recognize such interesting structural repairs, we have defined a number of heuristics. Slide 20. The first heuristic prefers to repair without non-contributing repairing actions. So if we are going to choose between repair 3 and repair 4, we would choose to use repair 3 because forelimb joint is a joint is actually redundant when we've already added limb joint is a joint. 21. The second heuristic is the information-based heuristic, where we prefer to repair using more informative repairing actions. A repairing action is more informative than another one if it allows us to derive everything that would be derivable by adding the second one, but more. For instance, limb joint is a joint is more informative than hip joint is a joint because it allows us to derive hip joint is a joint, but also something else. Limb joint is a joint, for instance. Now, interesting to see is that this limb joint is a joint. When we would add this, it actually was also a missing isolation, but it was not detected by our detection mechanism before. So always these more informative repairing actions will be really missing isolations, but they were not detected by the detection mechanism. Slide 22 shows the strict hierarchy heuristic, where we prefer not to change isorelations in the original ontology into equivalence relations. So if we would add body parts to our small ontology, where we know the joint is a body part, then adding body part is a joint to the ontology would allow us to derive hip joint is a joint. However, it would also introduce an equivalence between body part and joint. And then the final heuristic in slide 23 is the single relations heuristic, where we assume that it's more likely the domain expert misses a single relation than a chain of relations. So it's more likely that the domain expert misses that ankle joint is a limb joint than it misses ankle joint is NEC1, X1 is NEC2, X2 is NEC3, and so on to XK is a limb joint. Slide 24. To repair wrong isorelations, what we would need to do is to find the explanations or the derivation paths or the justifications of the wrong isorelation. So, for instance, for A is a B, we see a derivation path on the slide. And to repair this wrong isorelation, we would need to remove part of this justification. There may be different derivation paths, and then we need to take away parts of each of those derivation paths. So let's look at our approach, slide 25 and then 26. So our debugging approach contains three phases. In phase one, we detect the candidate missing isorelations. In phase two, they are validated by the domain expert and partitioned into missing and wrong isorelations. And then in phase three, the missing and wrong isorelations are repaired. So slide 27. The detection of the candidate missing isorelation is done according to the definition. So something is a candidate missing isorelation if it's derivable within the taxonomy, within the network, but not within the taxonomy alone. And we have shown that we actually don't need to look at every pair of concepts in the taxonomy, but it is enough to look at every pair of concepts that occur in mappings. Phase two, next slide. The domain expert validates them into missing and wrong isorelations. And then in phase three, next slide, 29, we start repairing. In the phase 3.1, we generate the possible repairing actions. And now I will give examples for missing isorelation. So if you go to slide 30, we see the missing isorelation hip joint is a joint. So what we do is we, for each missing isorelation, we compute two sets, a source set and a target set. And then it is guaranteed that when we take an element from the source set, an element from the target set, put an isorelation between them, and add this to the taxonomy, that the missing isorelation will be repaired. So for instance, we could take a limb joint from the source set, joint from the target set, and adding this to the ontology will repair hip joint is a joint. 31. Now there may be many missing isorelations to repair, and therefore we rank those with respect to the number of repairing actions. And the idea is that it may be easier for a domain expert to start with the ones where there are fewer repairing actions. Next slide. There may also be many repairing actions for each missing isorelation. So we have an algorithm that would recommend repairing actions for missing isorelations. And in this case, it will recommend the most informative repairing actions for which there's also evidence in external domain knowledge. And the ones that we use at the moment are WordNet and UMLS. And then finally, in phase 3.4, we execute the repairing actions, which includes computing all the consequences. For instance, by repairing some ISO relations, some other may be repaired as well, or by repairing some ISO relations, the repairing actions, the possible repairing actions for other ISO relations would can change. We have similar phases for the wrong ISO relations, slide 34. So when we generate repairing actions there, we do it on the justifications, as I talked about before. We also rank the wrong ISO relation based on the number of repairing actions. We have a recommendation algorithm, which is based on how often the ISO relations occur in different derivation paths. And in phase 3.4, we also need to compute all the consequences. So these algorithms have been implemented in a system that we call REPOSE, and we have done a number of experiments using that system. So this will be slide 35 and then slide 36. First, I will talk about a very small experiment, which is based on the bibliography data set of the Ontology Alignment Evaluation Initiative. And here the experiment is missing, which means that we're only looking for missing ISO relations. This means that there is an assumption that the mappings in the network are correct, but also the existing ISO structure is correct. And the bibliography data set contains five very small ontologies with a number of mappings. And the alignment is in a star shape, so only 101 has mappings to other ontologies. So slide 37. If we consider this data set as one network, you can actually find 22 missing ISO relations in the first ontology, one in each of 301, 302, 303, and 23 in the fifth ontology. And this whole debugging process takes about 5 minutes. Now, you can also look at these as four small networks. And what you find then is that, next slide, for 101, 301, you find one missing ISO relation in each of the ontologies, 101, 302, 17 for the first and one for the second. 101, 303, you find one missing ISO relation in 303. And for the last network, you find four for the first ontology and five for the second ontology. Now, when we compare the results from having one network or four network, you will find that the final ontologies for 301, 302, and 303 are the same in both scenarios. But 101 and 304, there will actually be more missing ISO relations found and repaired in that, in those ontologies. And this is as you expect, because when you consider this one network, the domain knowledge that you use is larger than if you look at it as four small networks. Slide 39. We did also some experiments with the anatomy data set. And there we find 205 missing ISO relations for the first ontology and 177 for the second one. Here the total debugging time was about 3 hours, but most of this time is on validation, which means looking up things in books and on Wikipedia. The system is actually quite responsive. And most cases, the ranking and the recommendations are useful. Slide 40. We also did an experiment where we tried to find both wrong and missing ISO relations, and this was now a later data set for an anatomy track, where we found 107 missing ISO relations for the first ontology, 64 for the second. We also found a number of wrong ISO relations and removed 3 from the first ontology and 12 from the other. And here the debugging time took about 5 hours. So let me conclude with saying a little bit about extensions that we did already and some future work. So slide 41 and 42. Further on taxonomies, we have extended this work by looking at debugging wrong and missing ISO structure as well as the mappings within the networks. And here we did some experiments on the anatomy data set, as well as some experiments for a real case for the Swedish National Food Agency, where they asked us to debug their own developed ontology, toxontology, and align it and further debug the network with mesh. Further in work that will be presented in 2 months, we integrated that with ontology alignment system that we developed earlier, and we see then aligning ontologies as a special case of detecting missing mappings. We have some algorithms for more expressive language, and this would be for ontologies which can be represented as ALC acyclic terminologies. The problem becomes much harder then, and although we do have algorithms, they're not very efficient. And finally, we have defined the repairing of missing isorelations as an abduction problem, and we're currently looking at complexity issues regarding this problem. Slide 43. So what we are going to do next is looking for algorithms for ontologies in more expressive languages. As I said, the problem becomes harder. We're also looking at complexity issues for the abduction problem for different languages, and we are defining preference criteria for solutions which are similar to the heuristics that I talked about before. And for these preference criteria, we also have to look at new algorithms and complexity issues. On slide 44, I have listed the papers on which this talk is built. And on page 45, there is a link to a page that I started to make, which contains publications in this field. And it's connected somehow to the WDOOM workshop, the international workshop on debugging ontologies and ontology mappings. And as I can advertise, the deadline for this year's workshop will be on Monday. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Patrick. That's very interesting, and I refer you to the discussion going on the chat board because of time, take the questions and answers at this point offline onto the chat, and hopefully we'll have time for verbal chats at the end of the session. But please take a look at that. There's some interesting comments being made. Our next talk is by Maria Copeland, University of Manchester, and this is the one that's talking about the life cycle observations of an ontology that is being developed. Maria, are you audible? Can you say something?
Yes, I am.
Okay, I can hear you. Please proceed.
Okay. Hi, I'm Maria Copeland. I'm from the University of Manchester, and the research I'm going to present today is about ontology regression analysis and how this fits within ontology regression testing. Slide number 2. So we have found that a lot of the studies on ontology evaluation tend to focus on individual ontology versions, or they provide information about shifts in the growth statistics, especially regarding structure and signature. In either case, we don't get objective and systematic evaluations of the lifespan of the ontology. Next slide. So our goal is to extract insightful and useful information out of all the existing versions of an ontology. Slide number 4. So, and this really is to tackle some of the ontology testing challenges. So one of the challenges is how to systematically identify test areas and also how to systematically analyze the impacts to the ontology. And the main goal is really to be able to minimize the testing effort and cost and still achieve adequate testing coverage. Slide 5. So one option is to look into software testing and get some insights on how this is conducted. Slide 6, please. Specifically, we want to look into software regression testing. This is an activity that systematically retests existing components after software changes. These changes can be due to changing requirements, modifications to specific areas of the software, or fixing bugs. And they are usually tested against current and updated requirements. Slide 7. Software regression testing usually takes place within aspects right? So we have testing against functional requirements. We could even have testing only on unit level and also on the system level. We also have testing against non-functional requirements and user requirements. We have a testing plan in software regression testing, which we get a defined testing criteria. We also get the identification of test areas and components. We get strategies on how to execute and evaluate the test results and what updates need to be made on relevant documentation. All of this works within a process, a defined process, and each one of these phases has its own specific tasks. We have a change in detection phase, an impact analysis, a test plan definition phase, a building of test cases. Then we have the running of the test and the evaluation of this test. And sometimes the test needs to be rerun multiple times. And finally, we need to know how to report these outcomes. So how does this fit within ontology regression testing? Slide 10 and 11. So when we look into change detection, we do have information about explicit changes. So for instance, if we have a class that's going to be added into an ontology, we do have information about the definition, therefore the different properties of this class, and we could confirm with the main experts the composition of the asserted axioms. However, we don't have information about implicit changes, such as what sort of entailments are we looking for within the ontology? What is the hierarchical structure of the subsumption changes? Slide 12. When we move into the phase of impact analysis, it's not clear at this point whether we should test against only the previous versions or should we make a more complete test and test all versions. When we're looking into the impact, should we look at the difference in content or just the asserted content or the intel content? Do we need to look at justifications if any of our applications are using justifications? And also, how do we map the impact of our test to our requirements and which ones do we test? When we define a test plan, we need to have a clear test criteria and also a test area. And at this point, it's very difficult to identify specific test areas within an ontology. We need to run this test systematically and ideally automatically so we have safe effort and time. And we need to be able to interpret the results in a meaningful way, not just for the engineers, but also for the users. Slide 14. In the final phases, we should be able to systematically build the test cases, run them, evaluate them, and rerun them if necessary. Slide 15. So if we take a look back at building the test suite, we do have some information, some tools available to us about the manual and automated test cases. With manuals, we could check our ontology against a preferred methodology or use many heuristics, you know, some of which we have heard in this talk. From the automatic side, we could use the reasoner to check for satisfiability and inconsistency. Slide 16. But we find that this type of test that we have available at this point, they're limited. When we conduct manual tests, it's time-consuming and it's very subjective either to the tester or to the domain expert, and it's also sometimes run in an unsystematic way. If we look at the automated test cases, we're very based on reasoners, so we're limited only to checks for satisfiability and consistency. Slide 17. So the question for this research is, how can we span the range of automatic test suites? And we believe we can expand it by analyzing the ontology dynamics. Slide 19. We define ontology dynamics as the study of the periods of growth and decline and the stability. We look specifically at the axon's presence throughout all the versions of the ontology. We need to find information about type of presence. Are axons appearing continually or not? And also, we should be able to identify editing sequences and patterns. Slide 20. So we can expect, when we look at the axon lifespan, to have axons that enter in one version and stay throughout the life of the ontology unchanged. On slide 21, another expected pattern will be that an axon enters in one version, it stays unchanged for a few versions, then in a different version, it's modified in some way, and it remains throughout the rest of the ontology. Slide 22, we also expect to find axioms that are present in the ontology, but then later removed in later versions. Slide 23, so to test these assumptions, we conducted a test on the NCIT. Slide 24, as you know, the NCIT is the largest collaborative ontology about cancer research. For this study on evolution, we found it very good that we could find multiple publications about the process, the quality control, the usage, and also critiques to the ontology. We also have monthly releases of the OWL ontology and the concept change logs. All of these provide a rich, unexploited ontology evaluation data. Slide 25. So when we conducted the NCIT dynamics, we parse each one of the versions and extract the individual axons, classes, and properties. When looking into axons lifespan analysis, we find that the majority of axons present in the NCI have been part of the NCIT for 11 versions. Slide 26. Once we have those results, we were able to ask more specific questions, such as what is the percentage of consecutive appearances and non-appearances? Also specific information about in which versions they enter and they exit and how long they stay. Slide 27, please. Within the top high frequency distributions, frequency meaning in how many versions an axon stays, we found that 6.73% of the axioms found in the last study version have been in the NCI from the beginning of the OWL ontology until August 2012, when our study ended. Slide 28. We also find that we have a large number of axons that appear consecutively in the NCI. Slide 29. We were also able to identify the axons that don't appear consecutively and identify the patterns of entrance and exits of these axioms. One of the patterns we identified was that an axon was added effectually in one version. What I mean added effectually is that it's added to the asserted set and also is entailed by the ontology. In a later version, it's removed effectually, meaning that it's removed from the asserted list and it's also removed from the entailment set. There's a gap between the next entry of this unchanged axiom, where it's added effectually again, it remains in the ontology for a few versions, and then is later removed. Slide 39, please. We also find patterns where an axiom enters the ontology effectually, then it's removed only from the asserted list in a later version, then a few versions later, it's removed effectually, meaning that it's also removed from the entailment list, and there is a gap before it's added again. So we are identifying, in these two cases, conclusive regression events. Slide 31, please. One of the most interesting findings in the sequences is that there are axioms that appear in the ontology only ineffectually, meaning that they're only part of the entailment set, but they have never been asserted. And there are also patterns of entry and exits of these axioms. Slide 32. In this table, I present all the axioms for the top frequencies that have non-consecutive entrances. And from this, you can see that we are able to not only identify the exact versions where they enter and exit, but also classify them between their effectual and ineffectual patterns. This means that we have been able to identify bugs, especially regression bugs in the ontology, the sequence of these bugs, and their location. We know for sure that when we have an effectually removed axiom that re-enters the ontology, there is a regression to the content. We don't know whether the bug was on the removal of the axiom, and then it's fixed by re-entering the ontology, and then the bug appears again when it's removed, or if the bug is the actual presence of the axiom, then it's fixed by its removal, and the bug re-enters the ontology when it's added again. Slide 35. Analyzing the sequence where we have an effectual addition and followed by an ineffectual removal, if we conduct a different analysis of them and see if the actual axiom is removed from the asserted list but still entailed by the ontology, this could indicate that there's some sort of refactoring in the knowledge. Slide 36. And although we cannot identify from the versions what is the design decisions behind the sequences of ineffectual additions and removals, we are definitely able to suggest that there is a fault in the sequence of these changes. So as you can see, slide 37, from analyzing the change dynamics within an ontology, we can identify regression variants and include this information into regression testing. Slide 38. Specifically, this information we believe helps in building the test cases. And because this is done in a systematic way, it guarantees that it could be reproducible. And also, we are able not only to, slide 39, we're not only able to identify conclusive regressions and refactoring, but we're also able to suggest faults that are happening in the regression sequence. We believe that this is efficient and a cheap way to run regression testing. Slide 40. There's still more potentials around this research. Slide 41. We want to conduct more research around the entailment set. At this point, we only have looked at unchanged asserted axioms. We want to proceed to looking at the entailment set and see how the knowledge has changed throughout the lifetime of the ontology. We should also be able to look into the subdomain dynamics. This is either by extracting information from the documentation, such as, for example, in the NCI, we know that the ontology has been modeled in such a way that you have specific domains such as anatomy, but you can also run module extraction from the ontologies and carry dynamic analysis on that. And we do believe we could also get this fine level of detail on other entities of the ontology, such as classes and properties. Slide 42, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, Maria. That was a very interesting and novel approach using life cycle. I thought we haven't seen that to date. Our next talk is by Melissa Handel of Oregon Health and Science University, and she's going to be addressing some of the issues of trying to merge and map different ontologies from the perspective of a biologist. And Melissa, can you say something? Make sure we can hear you. Nope. Can't hear you yet. Maybe *7 again on your phone. I mean, on the keypad. Nope. Can anyone hear me?
Can you hear me?
Ah, yes. Okay.
Great.
Good. All right. Why don't you go ahead?
Thanks very much, and thanks everyone for inviting me. I hope that my perspective will prove useful to some of you. Certainly some of the things that you've been saying in the last few talks have been quite pertinent to the work that I do, so it'd be interesting to find some further synergies. And I apologize, my talk is a bit shorter than the others. I thought I only had 20 minutes, so we can stop and talk about examples if we'd like. The first thing that I wanted to talk about was how the way in which the biologists that I work with use ontologies perhaps has a slightly different function than many of the ontologies that you all may work with. In particular, it's used for biologists to communicate with one another. And I think this is a point that's sometimes lost in the ontology development process. But it's, of course, also used to communicate with computers and to retrieve data and to do all kinds of things, and in particular in my field, to annotate and structure and map data in a consistent manner across different domains and across different data sets. And then, of course, it's used to retrieve that data. And in this particular example, it's used to pull information about mouse genotypes and relate them to other species. However, biologists have issues. Biology is particularly challenging due to the moving conceptual targets. What we think of as a gene today, we don't agree on. We don't agree on what it means to be an allele. Back in the times of when Mendel was first discovering the concept of a gene from his work on peas, that concept is a very different concept than the concept that we have today. And we still call it the same thing, and it's related, but it's a moving target. And even today, when we talk about conceptually what we mean by a gene, it's a very contextual concept. And so this is a real struggle, and I'm sure many of you have deal with this struggle all the time. We also like to reuse the same labels for similar things that may have very little to do with each other. And here's an example where the label tibia has been given to a skeletal element, the part of the lower limb, which, of course, we had in the previous talk example. Limbs are actually something of interest to me. Slide number 4. So here on the left, we have a fruit fly limb, and if we would like to call it a limb, it's a leg. And on the right, we have a human limb, and there are two parts of those limbs, so there is something in common. There are parts of these limbs, but the fruit fly part of limb called tibia is not a bone. It's not a skeletal element at all, whereas the one on the right from human is one that we're talking about being a skeletal element. And so we have to be very careful where we have these the same label is used to mean some part of the limb, some part of the leg, but otherwise we're really talking about two very different classes of things in the world. And some of the work that I do involves bringing things together, like fruit fly legs and human legs, and we have to have the ability to distinguish between these different types of things, given the fact that the anatomists are reusing these labels left and right. So not only do we not agree on concepts, but we also use the same labels for different concepts all the time. So how do we achieve these goals of communication and the ability to annotate and classify data, given the fact that we don't agree on anything and we use the same labels for everything? So it would seem then that quality textual documentation and definitions would be a simple solution to some of these issues.
but it's really not that simple. So first of all, the definitions, the textual definitions, the metadata that comes along with our logical class definitions must not only describe the concept, but must allow determination of real instances by a domain expert. And you have to realize that the people reviewing these definitions when they're annotating the data may not understand all the logical consequences of the ontology. So the information that is present in the textual documentation is critical for them to be able to assign an ontology class to a given piece of data. And so it requires very specific consideration of specific and precise concepts that are defined in this textual documentation. And this is where it's very important to delineate the specific properties and their use in the definition. So, you know, when I work with domain experts who may not even know what an ontology is or what the word even means, I say, well, tell me, what does, you know, how does the thing that you're trying to define, what differentiates it from other things? What are the specific properties that will allow you to classify something as this thing rather than that thing? And you realize that biologists have been classifying information all of their lives, and they're more than happy to give you the information if you ask it in that way. So the goal of all of this is to think about the ontology metadata and the textual documentation as a concept-first approach to creating.
Slide eight, are you on?
I am just on slide 7, but yes, we can move to slide 8 now, please. Sorry.
Okay.
So a concept-first approach to examining the specific content of a definition helps us avoid some label bias, and I'll talk about that in a minute. But here I'd like to talk about an example that where we had a lot of confusion about the definition of molecular labels. Some of the other terminology that's used to describe these particular research reagents, if you will, probes, tracers, detectors, reporters, and these are used to variably describe reagents with different characteristics. They are specific things used in biomedical research to label cells, to label molecules, to track, a transport of molecules in a tissue or cell, and they can be fluorescent or radioactive. And in some way, they provide some indicator of what's on in the biology. And biologists use the word label to mean very many different things. So this has led to a lot of confusion, ambiguity, and inconsistency in different ontologies that try to represent different aspects of how labels are created or used or indicated in different biological contexts. So basically what one would do in this case is you just throw out all the labels and consider the concepts that we're trying to represent. And there basically are, in this example, two concepts. One is the ability for one of these reagents to specifically associate with a molecular target, and detectability, and that's the ability for it to emit or produce some signal that's used to track it. And so if we start talking about those two specific differentiating characteristics, we can get away from the label issues. And now we can go to slide 9, please. So in this case, we just made ourselves a little diagram here. We'll talk about the first axis, which is targeting. So does the thing being targeted, does the molecule that one is considering as a label, quote, bind valently to the thing that we're trying to trace, or is it a targeted thing? So is it a molecule that recognizes another molecule, or is it one that needs to be bound chemically by it? And then the second axis is it something that can be radioactive or fluorescent in the way it's detected, or does it require another mechanism to probe for that detectability? And in doing so, by applying these axes to the particular subclasses that we're trying to represent, we can now apply a more descriptive labeling scheme for such things. And so now we, instead of one class of label that was inconsistently used across a number of different ontologies, We have four classes that very specifically represent covalent reporters, covalent trackers, targeted reporters, targeted trackers, and a community that agrees on what these things mean. Please go to slide number 10. But you might imagine a common source of problems is for developers is imposing assumptions about the semantic content of a label. And this is that last case is an example of where that had occurred. And similarly with the tibia example is a problem with what does that label actually mean. So it's best to avoid terms with varied and ambiguous meanings, but of course in biology, as I suggested earlier, there are very many cases where we are ambiguous or we've reused the label to mean different things, such as molecular probes, cell lines, et cetera. So we have to be very careful to document the ambiguity and give a precise definition that it is clear about a specific view of what that label is referring to in that particular context. And there is an OBO Foundry principle that suggests the use of numeric URIs. And this has proved to be very, very helpful for the biological community because we are much less attached to our labels if they are not built into the URIs. We find it more difficult to obsolete a class when we adjust its definition either logically or even the text information associated with the class if it's just a label change. But when the label is in the URI, it results in a lot of URI churn. So it's much easier to deal with a representation where the URIs are numeric. So how do we evaluate text depth? Things that the biologists use when they're using ontology. Our class look at things like properties defined textually as well as logically in ontology.
Maria, you're dropping out. I'm not sure if other people are having this trouble.
Let me try to put my voice close to the microphone. Is that better?
A little better. You're still clipping a little bit.
Let's see. I'm not sure what to do here.
Yeah, it might be a bandwidth issue. I'm not sure. Peter, are you having trouble hearing?
Exactly the way you are perceiving it. The large blanks that didn't come through.
Well, maybe, Maria, you just speak a little slower. Maybe we'll be able to hear you okay that way.
Okay. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. I'm going to go closer to the wire here.
Yeah, it was the beginning of slide 11 where it started to really drop out.
So evaluating text definitions, and please interrupt me again if that's not better. How do we, when looking at ontologies for reuse in biology or for use in an annotation project, these are some of the things that we evaluate. Are all of the classes and properties defined textually as well as logically? Do they avoid the use of figurative or obscure language? And are there citations? Because oftentimes the application of a class to a piece of data will require a biologist to investigate further than what the metadata has provided in the ontology. So having those citations is really helpful. Are there essential features for distinguishing from other classes included? And this is where we prefer an Aristotelian or genus differentia style structure in the textual definitions in order to help the biologist assess whether or not that class applies to the piece of data that they're interested in. And this is especially important for classes that may be imported from another ontology, where there may be logical inconsistencies in trying to merge ontologies by use of one ontology class in another. Another issue to look for is circularity avoided. So, for example, a class specimen collection objective is defined as the objective to collect a specimen. Well, that may not be incorrect, but it's not very helpful to an end user. And this relates back to to what was being said in some of the earlier talks, in the sense that one of the things that we would really like to have is the ability to roll together textual definitions from the logical ones, so that a user who is looking at the objective to collect a specimen can see the actual textual definition of a specimen in the context of the class specimen collection objective, so that they don't have to navigate the full ontology in order to determine whether or not a class is applicable to them. And the gene ontology in particular, to some people's great dismay, does a lot of this, where they recapitulate quite inconsistently in places the definitions of other classes that are referred to in the text definition. And so I think there's a real tool problem here, in the sense that we really like to create human readable definitions that leverage the dependencies between classes in the context of viewing one class's text definition. Hopefully that makes sense. So a last evaluating text definitions issue is to be able to determine if there are clear instances in reality. And we want to be able to test whether or not that class applies to a candidate set of instances. Slide number 12, please. So, for example, the class genetic material. This is a complex and nuanced concept, which is subject to varied interpretations, of course. And its precise definition is needed for use in diverse research communities such as genomics, experimental biology, and the model organism community. And when you review the definitions that are found on the web or in other locations, they're correct, but they're very, very vague and insufficient, and are not precise enough to delineate the instances in reality or have a biologist apply this class in the context of annotating biological data. So, for example, material of plant, animal, microbial, or other origin containing functional units of heredity is not sufficient for applying that class to a piece of biological data. Slide number 13, please. So, testing definitions against instances. So, a more precise definition would be a nucleic acid macromolecule that is part of a cell or virion and has the disposition to be replicated and inherited by descendants. So, now that we have a more precise definition of genetic material, we can start testing it against instances to determine if it's sufficient for classification. So, first, chromosomal DNA in dividing cells. The biologist says, okay, that instance would classify as genetic material. What about chromosomal DNA in postmitotic cells? Well, the DNA in a postmitotic, that's an undividing neuron, for example, does not have the disposition to be replicated and inherited by descendants, because the cell does not have a disposition to divide. So now we have a problem. So something that we want to classify as genetic material will not classify as genetic material based on the current text definition. And, of course, the text definition should be reflective of the logical definition. So we have a problem. So then we go and we refine the definition. So now we say a nucleic acid macromolecule that is part of a cell or virion and is inherited from an immediate ancestor or incorporated in a manner that has the disposition to be replicated and inherited by descendants. And now our chromosomal DNA in our postmitotic cells will classify as genetic material. Slide 14, please. So we continue with this sort of thing, and we look at a gene targeting DNA construct transfected into a cell. Okay, that works. That's something we'd expect to be classified as genetic material. Let's think about a transiently transfected DNA expression construct. Well, we have a problem with this. We would expect this to be classified as genetic material, but it doesn't meet our strict definition. And the same is true with the micro-injected siRNA oligo, which is just a piece of DNA RNA that's injected into the cell. And in this case, really what we're looking at is we're trying to understand, okay, the genetic material class that we might need actually doesn't meet the needs of all the things that we're trying to classify. And the solution here is not to change the definition of the text definition or the logical definition of this class, but rather to think more clearly about what the label is of the thing that we're talking about, which is actually hereditary genetic material. And we need a different new class, genetic material, as a more inclusive parent that would include situations such as a transiently transfected DNA expression construct or a single injected oligo in a cell, which we might think of as genetic material, but it is not hereditary. And so in analyzing such textual definitions biologically, we can actually affect the structure of the ontology and the logical definitions therein. Slide 15, please. Other considerations are, does the ontology include extensive synonyms? These are enormously helpful for biologists to find the concepts that they're looking for and are relied upon heavily in very many applications, as many of you know. The other thing that's really an issue, and this really goes back to Maria's talk, is does the ontology include other internal documentation such as edit history? One of the issues that we constantly battle with in biology is the addition and subtraction of various axioms and not having a good record of why those decisions were made. We create comments and other kinds of annotation properties in order to capture this information about the modeling decisions that are made, but this is not reflected in any kind of automated way from the edit history itself. And it would be really wonderful to consider some tooling that would enable us to review the edit history of a class in the context of editing the ontology and being able to annotate that information with the design decisions or other kinds of comments that would help avoid the addition and subtraction of the same axiom over and over again as biologists reconsider the same difficult issues. Other information that's very helpful is who created or edited the term? What is its status? Have people agreed upon it? What are the modeling notes that arose during the course of understanding how that modeling was performed? And then last but certainly not least are examples of usage and counterexamples. It's extremely important for proper application of a class to biological data to have examples of usage. Even with all of the other kinds of text definitions and other kinds of synonyms and documentation, nothing beats having examples of what would classify, what instances would classify according to that class definition versus what would not. It's also the case that sometimes a concept is so complex that a definition neither the text nor the logical definition can disambiguate exclusion or inclusion of an instance. And this happens actually much more often than we might like to think. And it's really a significant problem that really relies solely on the textual documentation internally in the ontology to help support annotation consistency. Slide 16, please. Here's an example. So reagent, this is a class that's used every day in every biologist's life, practically. A material entity that bears a reagent role by virtue of it being intended for application in a scientific technique to participate in or have molecular parts that participate in a chemical reaction that facilitates the generation of data about some distinct entity or the generation of some distinct material specified output. So this is the best definition after 2 years of work, and it's similarly logically defined, that, a whole community of people have been able to come up with. And it's the best we can do. But we have things like pH meter probes that actually classify as a reagent according to these definitions that biologists would not consider a reagent. So what do we do about these problems? Well, we don't want to go to 3 years or 4 years on this. We just want to try to make some notes so we can move on and continue as we move forward in biology with these ever-changing biological concepts to document such things so that we can at least apply this class consistently even without proper logical or textual definitions. Slide 17, please. Another thing that we do in order to evaluate ontology is we can use scripts to check the ontology to make sure that the important metadata is present on all of the classes. on properties. So we look for missing definitions. We check to make sure everything has labels and doesn't have duplicate labels. We look to see that there's a source indicated. An example of usage, as I indicated, is very important. We look for mismatched synonyms, where, you know, classes that have an exact synonym of another class are usually an indication that there's a merge required, or an obsolescence required. Those sorts of things. And I think that kind of quality assurance on the textual metadata is very important to make an ontology useful for biologists. And last is an inclusion of some sort of curation status or metadata complete annotation on a class to indicate how ready is it for use by biologists. And some biological ontologies will actually use that those kinds of flags in their release processes to only include classes that have been vetted and indicated as such by some kind of flag or annotation property. Slide 18, please. So, of course, we also evaluate the logic of the ontology, and I'm not going to go into too much of that today, but one of the main things that we look for are true path violations. It's very common for biologists to forget that the classes that they are using or defining should meet the classification requirements of all of the superclasses. And they don't always understand transitivity. And so these kinds of problems are not usually caught by reasoners, but it's really more of a biology quality assurance thing to try to promote that kind of analysis of the ontology classes and provide proper documentation in the textual definitions to help with difficult decisions that had been made in the ontology structure that have logical implications in the lower graph. Another issue that biologists struggle with is a balance of realism and practicality. More realist-based ontologies in biology can be very helpful in the sense that biologists very much understand conceptually the relatedness of the classes and the properties are very intuitive. However, this must be balanced with, practicality, because in many cases there can be so many different properties and classes between two entities that they might actually collect instances of that it makes it very difficult for them to use in the context of an application or a biology annotation project. And so, you know, having shortcut relations or, you know, a slightly simpler model might actually facilitate better usage and more consistent annotation than a full-blown realism-based approach. And then last but not least, of course, does the inferred classification make sense biologically, and having better mechanisms for biologists to check for those kinds of errors that reasoners don't catch. Slide 19, please. So third is ontology reuse. One of the key facets that are important to us as biologists are being able to integrate biological knowledge across different ontologies and different data sets. And so trying to leverage ontologies that have interoperability with other ontologies is really a priority. And this is, in fact, one of the OBO principles. But in doing so, does the ontology actually reuse entities from other ontologies at key intersection points? Is it doing it well? Does it make sense to have those classes in the context of the ontology that's being viewed? Does another issue that we find is, does the ontology include a subset of an external entities with the closure, or does it import the entire external ontology? Because we've seen a lot of issues where somebody wants a few classes from another ontology, so then they import the entire 10,000 classes. With the kinds of reasoners that we have and applications that we have that have to consume such things, it's not always trivial for any given end user to be able to leverage those and fix those kinds of issues. So having having some nice release packages that provide only that what is needed and logically consistent to the end user is really important. Slide number 20, please. So It is important to validate the ontology against real data, and I know this is the intrinsic section of your forum, but I think it's really important to understand the iterative process that occurs between the data and the ontology development cycle. So I just wanted to give you one example. So slide 20, please. So in this example, we have two anatomical classes, the neural plate and the neural tube. And in one particular ontology, they're defined as existing during certain stages of development, the neural plate between the 5 to 9 somite stage and the 10 to 13 somite stage. And these are stages of development that of early development during the process of somitogenesis, which is when the iterative body plan is laid out. And in the latter case, the neural tube is present between the stages of 10 to 13 somites and the PRIM-5 stage. So in looking at the ontology, before this ontology, this happens to be a zebrafish ontology, but before this ontology gets released, we compare it to the data that we have. And if we find that we have a neural tube annotated instance, and you can see my little instance down there, that's present at 9 somites, now I know that there's an inconsistency. And so basically this class annotation to this neural tube instance at 9 somites is either not a neural tube, it's actually a neural plate, or the ontology is wrong and the stage class definition should be changed for neural tube, or the data should be migrated. And actually what we often find is that the ontology is wrong. Maybe the neural tube actually starts at 9 somites. And so we'll make those fixes and rerun it against the data to make sure that the ontology is consistent with the data before the ontology gets released. Slide number 22, please. So some ongoing intrinsic issues for the development of biological ontologies are that we lack tools to enable visualization and editing via transitive relations other than a subclass hierarchy. And this is a real problem in particular for anatomists who really like to view the partonomy, and the tools that we have are really insufficient for being able to do that. We also, and also just error checking on the partonomy in general. We could use better tools to help synchronize different pieces of ontologies that are reused from another ontology to look for cross-ontology inconsistencies, and also version control across the bits that are reused across ontologies. We've been working on standards for documentation, annotation properties, and layering import approaches for documenting in the ontologies themselves, and mechanisms for linking these out to trackers, lists, and wikis, where a lot of the documentation currently lives. So trying to have a better interaction between the ontology itself and any documentation and design decisions that are made about the content of the ontology. And then, as I suggested earlier, better ways to roll together the text definitions end users of a class. Slide 23, please. So I just want to say a special thanks to the two members of my group.
Melissa, you just started dropping out again, but okay, well, I think you got the gist of your talk anyway, and we recognize you're thanking your members of your group. If that's the end, I'll assume it is, since the technology seems to have muted you anyway. And I apologize for calling you Maria earlier. I recognize you're Melissa. So let me just move us along here, and please, you've already mentioned it on the chat board, I guess, that you're done, so thank you very much. Our last talk today, last but not least, is Ed Barkmeyer, who is going to be pointing out some structural pattern techniques that would be leading to higher quality ontologies. And then following that talk, time allowing, we will have some actual audio Q&A using the chat board. So, Ed, are you on? Can I test your voice?
Okay. Yeah. By the way, I'm going to say, you know, this is sort of from the sublime to the ridiculous. What's really going on here is that apart from the late invitation to present this, one of the things that I've really been pushing on from our end is getting some sort of standard patterns for things that show up in all kinds of ontologies. And these are really tend to be low-level things. In the abstract, I actually referred to something that isn't in the slide set, which is this idea from the EBXML community, the electronic business XML community, of core components. The basic thinking there was really not a bad idea. It says ultimately that when you have things like times of day, and you have things like addresses, and you have we will pick some examples here, quantities and code lists, right, that these are ideas that have uniform behaviors. They show up all over the place, and what you want to do is to be able to come up with a standard way of understanding these things, a standard way of representing these things, so that no matter where they appear, you don't get a dozen different ways of representing them, and you don't get a dozen different ideas about what they are. The problem that particular group has is they didn't know what to do after they'd done that. In the ontology world, we're still getting to be able to do that. And this, I'm picking just one topic out of that, which is an idea that's been around in that world, the EDI, the Electronic Data Interchange for Business Community, for years and years and years. And it's called code lists. And so this is something you will see in ontologies, and you might not recognize it in ontologies. And so that's what this talk is about. So going to slide two. The general problem is the case of, I'm going to say, classifiers. And we have to be careful about that have registered identifiers. Typically, there are an awful lot of things in which, at a particular level of ontology, we are modeling the general class of these things, and there are literally thousands of subclasses of this that we don't really want to model, but we have to tolerate the fact that it's going to be referenced. And that gets into these things having registered identifiers. There is some place you can go to find out what the names of all thousand of these are, okay? And their definitions, probably. And the problem is making sure that you get that right in the ontology model itself. There are several examples that are just on this slide. Diagnostic and treatment codes. Every healthcare insurance organization, every healthcare facility, pretty much in the civilized world, I think, has got some magic numbers or codes that go with particular diagnosis and treatment. And the reason for that is so that these things can go into databases and be tracked in some orderly way. But there is simply a standard set by the community that is what these things will be, what magic characteristics, what magic numbers or magic alphanumeric sequences will be used to identify these things. In a similar way, in an entirely different part of the world, you have hazardous material classifications. These things tend to be fairly simple. I mean, you know, they are hazmat 1 through 9 or something like that in one of the international trade things. The trick here is, though, that those things are called 1 through 9 at the moment, and they have specific definitions of what's in them and what the characteristics are that goes in that class. And yes, okay, you could model those 9 very, very carefully in your ontology, and the particular problem is that in another year there will be 11, and two of those will have changed. And one of the problems that you need to deal with is the problem of tracking information that is old and that was classified according to the previous set of characterizations and not according to the current ones. So there is this issue about what these classes are and how often they change, and ultimately, although there are properties associated with those classifications, typically what happens is that the material that you're talking about is identified as being an instance of that class. Yes, okay, it has a lot of properties, and what it really is very important, but for the purpose of management of safety precautions or shipping capabilities or whatever it is, you only care that it is or is not a member of class 9. Right, and that's one of the things. A similar idea applies to the notion of vehicle models. All right, they are, you know, every manufacturer, every vehicle manufacturer invents new ones every year. Okay, and nonetheless, these are classifiers of vehicle, right, if you like, and you need to have some means of dealing with this. And the question is, do you continue to make the ontology as rich as you possibly can? And if there are 37 automakers in the world and each of them produces 7 different kinds, then you have 250 different vehicle classes, and really that's not a lot, except that, of course, every 6 months you have to change them. Okay, that is the sort of problem that you deal with. And the solution to this thing is this idea of registered identifiers. And these things form what is typically called in the core components world a code list. So, two ideas, right? The idea of what a code is. It's simply a standardized name or an identifier for an individual thing. And that thing might be a class, but we're going to treat it as a thing. Okay, and it's associated always, wherever that code is registered, it is associated with a definition description of the thing, just as if it were an ontology class or an instance, an A box, and it also always names the thing as an instance of some class. That is, the code is for a certain kind of thing in the first place, and so these are the individuals in that category. A code list is simply the set of codes that is maintained somewhere that are all the instances of that class that we know about right now. It's subject to change over time because new things get added and sometimes old ones disappear. It can be a regulatory scheme. And as I said, like hazardous materials is effectively a regulatory scheme. And it's not necessarily comprehensive. A given code list may actually correspond to the extension of some subclass of the class of things you're talking about. It's not necessarily all of the things in that category. It's the set that belongs to some particular domain of control. And in effect, the membership in that subclass is, you know, has its name in this code list. And often as not, there's another reason it has to do with how this thing is controlled, but this goes back to the kind of thing Melissa was talking about these things being according to actual usages and actual practices. And so I'm going to talk about how these things show up in ontologies. Here is one of my favorites. You see this all the time. This is the bad model. We have a product that has a country of origin, okay? The product is said to have a data type property, which is hazard classification, and its value is a string. They're looking for...
slide 4, is that right, Ed?
Sorry?
Slide 4.
I'm sorry, I'm on slide 4, yes. Switching to slide 4, yes. Right, gone to slide 4. The idea here is that it has a data type property called hazard classification, which is said to be a string, right? And similarly, it says, right, okay, I have and the product has a country of origin, right? Here we're talking about international shipments. The product has a country of origin. That country, well, actually, it can have more than one, as it turns out, and that country has a country code, which is also a string. Now, as it turns out, country has country code, right, is probably not a bad property, and that really does almost sufficiently identify what the use of that string is. But product has hazard classification is probably not the only possible use of hazard classification. And as a consequence, throwing that thing in there as a string that belongs to this product, okay, and plays a role with respect to the product is not the way you really want to capture that thing, because that thing is a notion. Hazard classification is an idea, and it's a class in its own right, and it has a name, okay? And yes, okay, it turns out that for international trade, you have one thing for operation inside shipping across the United States, you have another for shipping across the EU, you have a third set, okay, there may be different sets of hazard classifications, okay, but ultimately, and they're all hazard classifications, but the bottom line is that this is really, this hazard classification, although it's a class, it is really a class. It's a notion that we actually have to have, and this model that reduces it to a string is actually losing an important part of the information with respect to integrating this with any other use of that concept, right? The better model that you sometimes see is a slight improvement on this, which is the decision that we're going to specialize the concept string. So a hazard classification is a subtype of string, right? And an ISO country code is a subtype of string. And now what we've done is to say, well, this thing is a string.
We're on slide 5.
Hello? Right, This thing is, and in fact, sorry, on slide five.
Yes,
I'm just switching to slide five to the better model. Yes, right. This thing is a strain.
May I request that you maybe stay a little further away from the mic? You're clipping.
All right. I didn't realize, yes. This is the opposite extreme, yes. Okay.
Yeah.
I'll just talk quieter. Okay. Anyway, I'm on slide five, yes. The idea here is that we end up saying that hazard classification is a subtype of strain. And that's actually wrong, right? What this is modeling, in a certain sense, this model is the sort of thing you often see as well. And this particular model, I would have described as an implementation model that is based on a principle that Shir Nisen observed many years ago. His observation is you start out by analyzing the world and you ask yourself and you treat nothing as data. Everything is an entity, all right? And you look at how entities are related to one another, and at some point you say, you know, about this particular entity, the only thing I know is its name. I don't care about any of its other properties because its name conveys everything I need to know. And so I'm going to say that that entity in my database will be represented by a string. All right, that's what's happened here. You have an entity which is hazard classification, and by making it a subtype of string, I'm equating it to its representation. And that's not what I mean to do here. That is actually a change. The hazard classification in some integrating ontology might have a great many properties, like, for example, what you have to do to be a member of that class. So in these cases, you really don't want to do this, but people do this kind of thing all the time. And the reason why I'm going this way is that the third item in here is that there's really a reference model for this stuff. And there is actually an international standard reference model for this stuff, which is a useful contribution for how to make an ontology good. It follows a standard that is nominally used. The particular behavior of this standard is that it is intended for the maintenance of standard collections of code values. And as a consequence, it is the rules by which the people who make the healthcare diagnostic codes and the hazard codes and so on typically operate. And that's why it's a useful model. Okay? If you do it their way, you will get their concept set. This thing was written, by the way, originally in the late 1990s by people who apparently were uneducated in modeling. They invented their own words for everything. As a consequence, we have to deal with the fact that their terminology is not something you would expect, but we can understand what it is. They begin with the idea that there is a conceptual domain. In this case, for example, the conceptual domain would be hazard classifications or medical disorders, for example. Okay? That's the conceptual domain. We would call that a classifier. Right, or a class, all right? Then they have what they call the data element concept. By that they mean the thing, the instance of it, right? In this case, we're talking about hazard classification subtype 9, right? Or we are talking about medical diagnostic code, blah, 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 medical diagnostic, blah, 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 which medical disorder, blah, 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 which is some particular category of lymph cancer, all right? Those things are the things, they are the data element concepts, right? The thing that they call a value domain is effectively the representation structure, the data type, but more accurately, it is the code list itself. It's the set of things that we're actually going to use to name these things, and the data elements are the names that are going to be used for these concepts. So what you have here is class as conceptual domain on slide six. Conceptual domain is the class, right? The data element concept is the instance. And on the right side, you have representations of those things, which is a set of codes and individual codes. And those are the value domain and the data element domain, respectively. Below that, you can see what is done for maintaining this kind of thing in the way in which you would maintain what is the metadata about these code things in the same way that one would want to have metadata about an ontology itself. These things, each of these things is itself something that is managed by the database, by the system, right? And it has names. And we will come to this phenomenon, how we use the names. And it has somebody who owns it and maintains it and all of that sort of stuff. And we'll come back to these bits a little bit later. It also has associated things that go with it, one of which is the administration record. Going to the things Maria was talking about, it shows you when these things appeared and disappeared and things of that form. And similarly, it can have associated reference documentation, citations, and so on. Some of these things are really very important in later ideas. model following this is that you have classifiers or classes and objects, right? And on the other side, you have code lists that represent the classifiers or some subclass of them, and the codes themselves that represent the individuals in that class. We're on slide 7, right? As a consequence, if you really want to know what one of these codes means, there is a context involved, right? Is you need to know what code list it was in to know what the code means. Now, sometimes everybody knows what code list that is in the sense that there is only one that's ever used, okay? But in many cases, there are multiple possible code lists, and you need the pair. You need to know what the code list was, and you need to know what the value in the code list is in order to identify the object. And that pair together is the identifier for the object. And it's as simple as that. This is the model you really want to use. Okay, and it fits the scheme, going on to slide 8, it fits the scheme that appears in ISO 11179. The classifier itself is the conceptual domain. The object is the data element, what they call the data element concept. The classifier is represented by the code list, or some subclass of the classifier is, right? And that's a value domain, and a code list is exactly what is meant by a value domain, as far as I can tell, right? And a code, right, is one of the data elements that belongs to that particular code value domain. And what we've done here is to notice that in their model, as an administered item, these things have naming entries, which is to say there's more to a naming entry than a name. They have names. And we're going to call out some particular elements of those names because they are going to be used in identifying things directly. This is how you get your identifiers. The code list has an identifier. In fact, it may have more than one, which come from its name list. And the code has a code typically has a single value, a single name, which is the code value itself. There are issues about whether you have multiple spellings of the code value and so on. That is really a separate concern. If you want to do that, then you have to have the possibility that you have to deal with the equivalence behavior somehow. And the way they do it, in theory, is that there are different versions of the same item. Sometimes, is my experience. Going on to slide 9. Simple example, actually not so simple example, but this one was just a simple tutorial example here, right? Country codes. We typically say, I'm going to represent a country by its code, right? So, and what we are thinking is, we see it called country code, right? Well, there are ISO country codes. These are the ones that you've actually seen on the internet among other places. This is DE for Deutschland, Germany, and UK for the United Kingdom, and US for the United States, except it doesn't usually show up in email addresses. and similarly FR for France and JP for Japan and so on. Those are the ISO country codes. That is a standard list. It is actually maintained in a repository as a standard, and part of the reason why it is maintained that way is the existence of something like South Sudan, which came into existence, 6 months ago, as a new country. And all of a sudden it has a country code, and that value didn't exist before. You maintain a registry somewhere of these things that has those codes in it that tell you what that value is, rather than having an enumerated type that simply is taken out of the standard and thrown out there, right? Because otherwise you have to keep changing it. And the whole idea of this thing is that there is a place that you can go to, one of those registries, that tells you what the code list is and what the current values in it are. So when you get one of these things, you know where to look it up. And that's really a very important part of the process. It's the kind of thing one does in ontology by materializing a database as needed, as used. And at least that's our experience. And these things are country codes, and that constitutes a value domain representing countries. On the other hand, most of us are familiar with an entirely different set of country codes, which are the International Telecommunications Union country codes, which assign magic numbers to the telephone systems of various nations. So +01, the United States, +49 is Germany, +33 is France. Those are also country codes. The ideas are the same in a certain sense. They are both the same conceptual domain. They represent countries, right? On the other hand, they are different code systems. They have different code values, and obviously you wouldn't have a problem recognizing an occurrence of 49 as probably not a representation of an ISO country code. But on the other side, there are places where obviously it is ambiguous. You do need to know where this thing comes from. So this is why there are different value domains associated with the same conceptual domain, Right. And they have different purposes. That's why they are different value domains. But ultimately, they are just versions of the notion country code, which is a registered identifier for a country. And that's what we're doing here. This model is a fairly simple view of something you see all the time. Going on to slide 10, part of the reason why we pick country codes is what I mentioned, that, in fact, the official, the ITU country codes, for example, have an associated reference document, which is an ITU specification that lists the magic numbers and the country codes in the document. That's the source of that particular set. Now, it's actually also available online. Okay. In a similar way, the ISO country codes are actually defined by ISO, I think, 3144. But and so there's really a document, except that the document is now out of date. I mean, it has to have undergone a revision to accommodate South Sudan, for example. But the ISO country code list is actually online via one of these registration authority things. And we're going to come back to this idea of online registries at the end. This is part of why you want the model to look like this, so that you can document where these values come from. And one possibility is this one, and we're using other elements of their model to identify where this thing comes from. Sometimes they simply come from a reference document, and that's still a useful idea. Then you know where it came from, and that's where this particular domain comes from. This is a more interesting example. This is called slide 11. Is a more interesting example in that it identifies a common problem for me, at least, and it demonstrates the use of several different code systems.
I hate to interrupt, but can you try and wrap it up in like 5 minutes? We're almost running out of time.
And I believe I'm on slide 11 of 13.
Okay.
Okay. The idea here is really very simple, that a part model the thing that you actually shipped, right, is associated with a part number, a part model. It's actually an instance. And notice here that, by the way, the ontology includes both the class and the instance. But we're really going to talk about these green things that we had were really metaclasses. They're templates, and that's what we were using there. So a part is a part model. The model, of course, has some identifying number, right? That's what these things are called. They're called part numbers, typically, right? And the part number is, of course, a code in somebody's system, right? Well, in fact, that code belongs to the organization, right? The manufacturer actually owns that code list. He defines the part numbers for his parts. And so the part number, but the organization itself typically uses, there are others, but it typically uses, is referenced by what is called a Dunn's ID. It's the Dunn and Bradstreet Registry of Businesses, which was originally in the U.S., but it's now worldwide. And pretty much every manufacturing company anyway has a Dunn's ID. There are others. There's a French system that is also used. And so that's a different code set, right, that belongs to the Dunn's registry, right? And that, of course, is changing daily. That's one of those things in which Dunn's IDs are, if you want to know what it is, you look it up in the current version of the registry online, all right? And finally, you have the idea that a part may have for benefit a material type. And here's another case where you want to model the type as a thing, and that it has a code that identifies it, which is a material type code. And, of course, everybody and his brother who delivers materials has a different type code set. You have things that are standards for certain industries, but you also have the set that's created by Dow and the set that's created by assorted, you know, French chemical companies or BASF, and the set that is created by the metals company, the assorted metals that are alloys made by Alcoa or Kennecott or whomever. I mean, this is the kind of thing you have. So here you have three different code systems, all in use and typically describing a part. And all we did in slide 12 here is look at how this relates to these ideas we had before. The part model itself is the so-called data element concept. That's the thing being modeled. Even though it's a class, we're actually modifying it as a thing. The organization is the registration authority for those part numbers. And that's what we were trying to show here. The part number is a code. The organization is the registration authority in the ISO 1179 model. All of this is the fact that ISO model is actually useful to understand the domain. Most of these green creatures on this diagram are templates. You would never instantiate them directly in the ontology, but they show you how to construct the ontology for this particular kind of thing. And that's really what the message was. And so here's the summary. The basic code listen code model is a good model for identifiers. It's simple, but it's not simplistic. The bad models are simplistic. It's consistent with an international standard for the guys who actually manage these things. And finally, the basic model is consistent with the basic codes model that they have is consistent with a whole set of aspects of codes management. Definitions, synonyms, change management, reference documents, registration authorities. If you happen to need those, you have a way to bring them into your model. That was the idea. And that said, I'm done.
Thank you, Ed. Sorry to rush you there at the end. I was starting to look at the clock. But we have just a few minutes anyway for anyone who has any burning questions, any of the speakers. I would encourage you to raise your hand on the chat board, and we have 6 minutes to cover any questions. Doug Fox.
Okay. My question to Ed is that what he's saying about code lists, the mappings are intrinsically ternary operations, that you're mapping something to a code in a code list. Are you really trying to do this all with binary things? Because the individual item will map to many codes in many different code lists. If it's a parts in a parts catalog, different companies will sell the same part, but will assign their own names to them, for example. So,
well, there's two different things going on there, Doug, very quickly. One is that in a certain sense, whether they are the same part or not is in the eye of the beholder. What you mean is that it's functionally equivalent or even that it's physically equivalent. And yes, I mean, we do talk about part number equivalences and part number and part alternatives. And that usually means in the business, people really talk about them as alternative parts. You're really saying this part from this manufacturer is exactly the same thing for my purposes as this part from this other manufacturer.
Right. Ed, I'm talking about different vendors will sell parts from the same company, but will have their own codes for.
That's fine. I mean, ultimately, the problem of how many different identifiers there are for the same thing is a different question from what the code list looks like. I mean, the argument is yes. I mean, of course, the same object can have multiple identifiers. The trick is that the identifier, I mean, in the same way, a person can have multiple versions of his name, if you like. I mean, the thing here is that it's only sort of an inverse functional property, right? It's not functional. The part can have multiple identifiers, but there is only one. Any given particular code in code list only identifies one thing. But it is a pair. You have to have the pair to identify the code. And the way in which that gets modeled, sometimes the half of that pair, which list it's coming from, is defined in other ways, right, than being immediately part of the code reference, right? For example, you know, if I have this part, I can say source and then part number. Okay, well, I mean in that case that the source, it's the source's part list that is going to, that number is going to show up in, right? So, I mean, this is the particular problem is when you actually make the model, how you pair those two things isn't always obvious. And there are other places where you explicitly have to say, hey, there's a pair here. The guy's got to provide me two things because, you know, if you're providing me with a material type, I need to know whether this is an ASME standard type or whether this is a Dow Chemical special.
Right.
So, I mean, that's some people just do that by creating subclasses, right? You know, standard material versus, you know, specialized material or whatever. So, I mean, these are very different things. I mean, the argument of how you do this is something that you see all the time. But it is important, yes. A given thing can have more than one code identifier. Yeah, that's really true. Even in the same table in some cases.
Right. Okay. So what you need is to either reify term in code in code set, or you need a ternary
predicate. Yes, right. As I said, or in the third case is that you actually have another predicate that links somehow to the code list. Right. If you have part has manufacturer, okay, well, then you know whose code list you're talking about. Or at least you hope you do.
Namespaces might also play a role if you want to think of it that way.
I have a really serious concern about the term namespace used in this regard. Namespace has to do with you know, XML objects and RDF objects maybe, but we're talking here about specific owners of lists of values. And
right.
you're talking about what the value looks like and where the value comes from, and not where the name in the XML comes from.
Right. Okay, Fabian, you have your hand up.
I have a question for Melissa. So a large chunk of Melissa's presentation was about the evaluation of the textual documentation which goes along, and in particular, also then testing this against instances in a way of going through examples and seeing, you know, does this definition of the term apply to the examples that I wanted to classify. And I was just wondering how much time it takes to do this evaluation, because I mean, on the hand, it seems rather work intensive, and on the other hand, the biomedical ontologies tend to be huge. So I was wondering about work balancing here, on what her experience is, how to do it in an efficient manner.
Melissa, you care to respond? Make sure your voice is heard. *7.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Yeah, it seems to lock me out regularly. So I think most important on some of the key distinctions in the ontology, like, you know, where, you know, you have a node in the ontology that's really important for the further development of subclasses. So we do a lot of work on those particular nodes to try to make sure that they really are representing the concepts that we want them to be before we explode the node. So I think, you know, it obviously is a lot of work, and of course a good correspondence between the logical axioms and the text definitions that biologists use to understand the application of the class is important. And that, we see, I think one of the main things that we look at takes a lot less time is just making sure that the text definitions match the logical axioms, because in many cases they don't. And so, you know, very, but does, you can't go through biology on every class that I showed you.
Okay.
Thank you.
We're running out of time here, actually, but maybe we can squeeze in. Pavitra, you had a question about intrinsic and extrinsic.
In the example that Ed was explaining, the part, it's the integration. If the part is, you have a product and product code and the part code. The part, if it's manufactured by somebody else, it's integration, that's extrinsic evaluation, right? Hello?
Ed, you want to touch on that? I mean,
I'm sorry, I didn't quite understand, Pavitra.
In the example that you had there, it's intrinsic versus extrinsic. Extrinsic, and the part is being manufactured by another manufacturer,
yes,
the product. That would be integration there, so that's extrinsic evaluation.
Okay, I guess I would have said that what I've really gotten onto is best practices in ontology development, and that's really what I was pushing here. So
okay.
my intrinsic evaluation here is really about whether this is a good or bad model relative to the what I would have said is the reference model for capturing these ideas like coding codes and codes and identifiers. That's really what the point was. I'm sorry. I mean, so yes, I agree that obviously these are going to be extrinsic information sources outside the ontology model per se, and effectively they're all just data elements for the ontology model, right?
Right.
Okay, thank you.
Right. Okay, Peter, you want to say something?
Yes, I already have it on the chat board, but I just wanted to make the solicitation openly on everyone, particularly to the panelists today. As part of the summit activities, we are conducting a survey of tools out there that support ontology evaluation helps in quality, guide processes, and so on. So please watch out on the Ontology Summit mailing list. Those of you who have done so much work on there, please help us by returning the survey or give us pointers like Melissa just did on who else are maybe developing or stewards of tools that would be interesting to be captured into the survey. And also for those of you who have methodologies and tools, we have an ontology clinic, also a hackathon activities being planned as well. So again, watch out on announcements in the mailing list. Thank you.
Okay. Good point. Okay, well, given the time, I think I'm going to have to close this session. I again want to thank Patrick Lambrix, Maria Copeland, Melissa Handel, and Ed Barkmeyer, our speakers today, and thank all of you, the rest of you, for participating and great chat discussion and dialogue and questions. So with that, I'm going to close this 8th session of the Ontology Summit, and hopefully we'll see you all again next week. Thanks very much.
Yeah, great session. Bye-bye.